Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History. You know, of all the people I had on the podcast, I haven't had many more remarkable thinkers and broadcasters than Kevin Fong. He's a scientist here in the UK. He's worked with NASA. He's working currently on the COVID response for NHS England, but he's also involved in high mortality, high morbidity terrorist attacks as well and the planning for them. And he's also an advisor to Virgin Galactic and, as I say, worked for NASA on the effect of space on the human body. He was the perfect person to present the BBC's smash hit podcasts on called 30 Minutes to the Moon on the Apollo mission to the moon, and its follow-up on Apollo 13. As this week's rerun, choosing the best from our back catalogue, I wanted to give this one another airing. It's an absolutely fantastic episode. Kevin Fong talking to me all about the extraordinary, extraordinary moment when humans first landed on the moon. It's just totally brilliant. If you want to watch documentaries either about the Apollo mission or anything else, we've got lots of history documentaries on History at TV. It's like Netflix for history. It's the world's best history channel, and there's no aliens on it. What can I say? It's brilliant. Go and check it out. If you use the code POD1, because you're a podcast listener, you get a special introductory deal. A month for free, and then next month for just £1, euro or dollar. I mean, that's super cheap. Go and do it, everybody. And you can listen to all these back episodes of the podcast as well. They're all up on there. But in the meantime, here is Kevin Fong. Enjoy. So we got the most expensive civilian project in the history of the human race to talk about in the course of this podcast. So where should we start? I mean, what was the how did humans go about landing on the moon?
Well, I mean, that's the crazy thing, and part of what this podcast series is about is how did we do it? Because Kennedy gives that speech to Congress in 1961, setting his country on course for the moon, and you think, okay, well, obviously he knows that someone knows how to get there. But no one knows. No one knows. The furthest they've been from the surface of the Earth is 250 nautical miles, and now he's going, let's go 250,000 miles. And as he gives that speech, at NASA, people are scrabbling for, oh my God, how are we going to do this? No one knows. How big does the rocket need to be? How many pieces of vehicle do we need to send? Who do we need to send? How are we going to get there? And so they have to invent the techniques and the technology, and that has to be done by a workforce that isn't recruited. So they're just hiring people as fast as they possibly can because they know they need to, because it's war. It's the Cold War. It's this ideological war for technological supremacy, United States over the Soviet Union. So it begins there, and they invent all of the technology they require in that short decade.
God, it just makes you think what we could do if we put our minds to it. It's almost depressing.
It's really important. The 20th century, if it taught us anything, it taught us that if you face a complex problem, but that there's no fundamental obstacle to it, if it's an engineering problem and you throw resource at it, then you solve it inside of a decade. It happens with the Manhattan Project. The first time we see nuclear fission is in 1939 in a laboratory, and you weaponize it inside of 6 years after that. The Apollo Project, you know, president says we'll go to the moon in 61, you're on the surface of the moon in 69. HIV is a good example. You know, you realize it's a killer in the mid-90s. It's a fatal illness, and now it's consistent with a normal life expectancy. So, yes, it tells us something really important about us, about the problems that we face now, which is if there's a will and it's just engineering, we can get there. And I feel like that. I feel there's an important lesson 50 years on for us, nuclear fusion, which would be really, really important. Why don't we have an Apollo-level effort to tell us how far into the future nuclear fusion is? Because if you approached it the same way you approached Apollo, in 10 years' time, if you didn't have it, there'd be something pretty wrong.
Exactly. And then we could go carbon negative into the atmosphere and the world would be a great place. So they throw a lot of resource at this. What are the what are the biggest challenges that they've got to overcome?
Yeah, it's all flights. And so now they need a rocket big enough to lift your vehicle, you know, and a larger vehicle from the Earth to the moon. They need to travel faster because you need to go not four, but you need to go close to 25,000 miles an hour to escape the escape velocity of the Earth, to get yourself all the way to the moon. When you get to the moon, you need to work out how you're going to land on the moon, how you're going to split your vehicles up. They choose this bizarre architecture. They choose to do this thing called Lunar Orbit Rendezvous, which means that you send one big rocket, two vehicles, all the way to the moon together, and then you split those vehicles up. You land one on the surface, and then it has to come off the surface and back up into orbit around the moon. They have to get together, and then they have to come home. And all of this is just absurd. You know, in 1961, all of these things just are the stuff of pure fantasy, and yet they do it all. They do it all in the course of that decade.
And what about the individuals? How do they start trying to choose the people that are going to go on this mission?
So astronaut selection is quite a thing. You know, when they start doing it at the time of Mercury, when Alan Shepard and John Glenn first fly, they don't know what space is. They don't know what physical threats and hardships space will offer. So they just choose the healthiest, toughest people they can find who can fly aircraft, because they just don't know. So basically, they just make the most resilient physical specimens who are also amazing pilots that they can find. That's how you get there, and that's kind of what they select for Apollo. And you need the best test pilots you can find, because this is the mother of all test pilot projects. These guys are going to be flying the most complicated vehicles in the history of the species in an environment where there's nowhere to safely crash land. If you stuff it up on the moon, that's it. Thanks for coming. You're not coming home. So it's a particular kind of person. But it's not just the astronauts. You know, the astronauts are just the tip of this gargantuan iceberg. It is the tiers and tiers and tiers of people who follow it. You know, there are the flight directors, the flight controllers, but there's the backrooms technical support. There's the guys out in the factory. You know, the success of the mission depends as much on the guy who puts the foil insulation around the legs of the lunar lander as it does the guy who's behind the desk in mission control. If anyone screws up, everyone dies.
And there were bad accidents, weren't there, in the early in the first few years.
Well, the episode that we're just actually putting to bed at the moment is all about the Apollo 1 fire, where three astronauts die in a horrific fire on the launch pad in 1967. And so that's one of the things that's worth remembering. So we know that there was an Apollo 1 fire, but actually it hadn't quite occurred to me how late in the game it happens. It happens in 1967, you know, so 2 years, just over 2 years before they actually get onto the moon and they kill a crew of astronauts. And that story was one that, as we unpicked it during the making of 13 Minutes to the Moon, as we unpicked it, I realised there was much more to it than I thought. You know, up until 67, NASA are basically falling over themselves in their efforts to get to the moon before the decade is out. And actually, it's a bit of a mess. We talked to people who said, look, you know, in 64, between 64 and 67, everything's behind schedule. The lunar module, the vehicle that's going to land on the moon, is behind schedule. It's not going to be ready in time for the early testing. The command module, the thing that they fly to the moon in, it's just a really bad vehicle. It's really bad workmanship. It's really badly put together. And this pressure and this sort of like pressure to try and deliver, what they call go fever, you know, we've got to go, all of that conspires to create a situation in which in 1967 you put a crew into a badly designed, badly maintained capsule, you fill it with pure oxygen, and there's faulty wiring in that cabin, and the rest is history. You know, you kill Gus Grissom, Roger Chaffee, and Ed White, and at that point NASA could have said, well, that's it, we're done, we're not going to the moon. But in fact what they do is they recalibrate their culture. They reset their culture. They realize that they've got to change everything about their culture and the way they're doing things, and they redouble their efforts. And in the 21 months that follows that, NASA is a changed organization. You see, when we tell this story of Apollo, it's as if Kennedy makes his speech, everyone hears his rallying cry, and then everyone executes this perfect 8-9 year program of work to get everyone to the moon. But actually, it's a mess, and it's a mess for probably the first half of that 8 or 9 year effort. And so the fire, and we had George Abbey, a huge figure, a really totemic figure in the history of human spaceflight at NASA. He said it's a terrible, terrible price to pay, terrible sacrifice. But if we hadn't had the Apollo 1 fire, we hadn't had that to reset our culture, we probably wouldn't have got to the moon by 69. We may never have got to the moon.
Wow. Why do you call it 13 minutes to the moon?
So it's such a huge topic, isn't it? It's a decade of work. It's 400,000 people. There's so much technical information. We thought, where can we focus this? What is the unique... is the crescendo of this whole story, and what's the unique thing that we can focus upon? And for us, it was that 13 minutes of descent. So when Armstrong and Aldrin fire the descent engine on the lunar module above the moon to commit them to the moon's gravity to start their attempt at landing, because up until that point in 69, no one has done that. And it's the period of mission, that 13 minutes from taking them out of Earth orbit onto the moon, that 13-minute period taking them out of lunar orbit onto the moon that Armstrong most worried about. He said, and he said, you know, it was rampant with unknowns. I was worried about it. And, you know, this is a guy who doesn't worry about much. And he was right. He was right.
So they're in moon orbit. They're in lunar orbit. There's three of them in the... What's that spacecraft called?
So they're in the command module. Now, the command module is that cone-shaped vehicle that you see. And you've got to think of that a bit like it's like a yacht, you know, that has your accommodation and your food and your amenities. It's actually relatively comfortable and relatively capable compared to the lunar module, which is that spidery angular vehicle that you see, which is flimsy. It's very, very light. It's kind of like, you know, the dinghy that you take off your yacht to go and visit a nearby island. In fact, that's exactly the design of that mission. So Michael Collins is left in the command module. We interviewed him. He was fantastic to interview. It was quite hard to interview, actually, but fantastic. And so he waits in orbit around the moon, and he's got a big job. If it all goes wrong, he has to fly down and rescue them. You know, if they're aborting off the moon, he has to kind of fly down and pick them up, you know, as they're coming off. And so people underestimate how important his role. He was the second most senior person on that mission. It's Armstrong, Collins, and then Aldrin. Aldrin's the most junior pilot on that mission. Anyway, Armstrong and Aldrin are coming off. They're going down to Aldrin. It's ridiculous vehicle. It looks like nothing on Earth because it's never meant to fly on Earth. It has no aerodynamic features. They're inside it. It's a thin-skinned vehicle. It has to be light. It's so thin-skinned that if you took a pen, you could stick it through the skin of the vehicle. That's what they're in. That's what they're sealed in to protect them against the vacuum of space. And they're coming down. And as soon as they start into that descent, things start to go wrong. So Armstrong was absolutely right to worry about the 13 minutes because everything happens. Communication starts to play up. And Armstrong says, we'd rehearsed everything. We hadn't rehearsed bad communications. They track their progress across the moon's surface, and Armstrong knows that they're seeing some of the lunar features too quickly. Some of the craters and some of the mountains are coming up too quickly. So he's going too fast. They're going to miss their landing site. And that's important because if they come down in the wrong place, they're going to damage the vehicle. They're going to get onto the moon, and then they're going to get off of it again. And then if that's not enough, then they have problems with the onboard computer, which they absolutely depend upon. You know, they can't fly this vehicle on their own. They need a computer to assist them. And that starts to throw up error code after error code after error code. And then if that's not enough, as they get close to the surface, Armstrong has to take some control back from the computer to try and manually affect the landing because they're about to come down in a boulder field. And he very nearly runs out of fuel. He gets down to about 20 seconds of fuel, 30 seconds of fuel before he actually sets it down. And everyone in Mission Control thinks, well, we're done. We're not getting to the moon today. We might crash. But he still lands it. It was an incredible 13 minutes.
This is After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds, and the Paranormal.
The podcast that takes you to the shadiest corners of the past, unpicking history's spookiest, strangest, and most sinister stories. I'm Maddie Pelling.
And I'm Anthony Delaney. Join us every Monday and Thursday, and we'll take a look at the darker side of history, from haunted pubs to Houdini to witch trials and arsenic-laced breakfasts.
Follow After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds, and the Paranormal wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
And then they land successfully on the moon. Have they ever told anyone? Did they celebrate? Were they just thinking about the next 5, 10 minutes, an hour, or what was that moment like when they're sitting on the moon's surface?
Well, and that's what you think, isn't it? So once you've landed on the moon, it's time for massive celebration. But we talked to them about this. In fact, we talked to not just some of the astronauts, but the mission controllers. And here's the thing. When you land on the moon, your problems are far from over. So actually what you hear in the mission audio is them sort of saying, we've landed, and then they've got a group. They've got, after the landing, they've got the stay, no stay decision. So just because you've landed on the moon, can you stay there? Or are you going to need to take off instantly? They didn't know what the moon was really made of at that point. Was the vehicle going to sink? Was it going to fall over? If they were on a slope that was too steep, they were going to have to lift straight away. So for the first few minutes after they get there, there's a furious work rate for them and the mission controllers trying to make sure that something awful isn't going to happen and they're going to have to just get the hell out of there. Because, you know, the risk is far from over. So there's a very muted celebration. And then they get on with the business of knowing whether or not they're safe. And I think after that, then, you know, you have to understand that once you're on the moon, you're still in the most alien and exposed environment any human being in the history, I guess in the history of our species has ever been in. And so, Armstrong was all about the job. And so, you know, he wouldn't have been high-fiving Aldrin for very long, I don't think.
It's from your description of the descent, if it hadn't been Armstrong was the difference between success and failure, his skill there.
It's really interesting. I think an awful lot about this because it informs actually the work I do as a doctor. Armstrong is absolutely essential. You need an Armstrong because you need someone inside the loop of control of this complex system. But he's necessary, but he's not sufficient. So you need Aldrin, you need Collins up top. You need the guys who built the vehicles. You need the flight director. You need the flight controllers who are running all of the subsystems. No one can see all the moving parts. And this is really best illustrated by one of the interviewees you had, my favorite. You know, we spoke to about 5 or 6 astronauts in the making of this. But my favorite interview was actually this junior flight controller who at the time was 26 years old. His name was Stephen Bales. And he's epic. His story is epic. I loved it. We went to his house near New Jersey, sat down with him. He's a lovely guy. He is like the Luke Skywalker of the Apollo program. He grows up in Iowa in farmland. He walks out into the fields at night. He looks at the sky, dreams of the stars and the adventurous space. He equips himself with an engineering degree. He goes off to Houston to the hustle and bustle. He's a T-boy. He gives visiting dignitaries tours of mission control, but finally earns himself a place to work on the desks in his dream place. And he proves himself. He proves himself through training and simulation. And so in the end, when they're selecting the team of guys who's going to be in the room to assist the Apollo 11 landing, he finds himself behind the guidance officer's desk, one of the most critical desks. He's 26. And it was funny, because when we interviewed him, he still, even 50 years on, I don't think he could quite believe he'd been there. You know, he said to us, you know, there I was, this 26-year-old kid, and I could stop the space mission. And I mean, even then he couldn't. And here's the thing. At one point during the mission, Armstrong sees these error codes flashing up on his crappy computer in the cabin of this vehicle. 1202 alarm. He doesn't know what it means. Armstrong doesn't know what it means. The flight director doesn't know what it means. Nobody knows. And if the computer falls over, they die. That's it. Done. Period. So Armstrong calls down, says 1202, what does it mean? It goes to him. And so now, with only a few minutes left before you're supposed to land on the surface. Armstrong is saying, what the hell's going on? Do I abort? Am I going to die? What's going to happen? It's come down and all eyes now turn to this 26-year-old boy who's from Iowa, who's sitting behind the desk. And he's like, well, what do you reckon, Steve? And Steve, not fortunately, he works hard. And so he is prepared for this. He has every single alarm code documented, he and his backroom team. And they have, in 15 seconds, they have this little chatter and they say, we're okay to go. Go, tell him to go. And he makes the decision that saves the mission. You know, boy from Iowa, 26. I don't know what you were doing at 26, but I wasn't saving space missions.
And then, so how long do they spend on the moon?
So that was flags and footprints jobs. So they're there for not very long. They're there for a few hours, really. And you know, as the Apollo program continues, so you've got 11 program, you've got six landings in total, 11 through 17. So the first few missions are really just pathfinder missions. Get out, walk around, get the flag down, get the hell out of there before something unknown happens. As we move on through Apollo 15 is the first time, they've got so confident with them, they're taking lunar rovers up there. So they're driving around the moon. So the J missions, which are 15, 16 and 17, you know, they're driving buggies around the moon. And they're then spending several days, they're camping on the moon. And in fact, one of the people we spoke to was Charlie Duke from Apollo 16, who actually spent several, you know, a good couple of days on the moon. And he talks about, you know, camping on the moon. You string up, there's a bit of gravity, not the same gravity on Earth, but there's a bit of gravity, so you string up a hammock. But the cabin's so small that, you know, you can't have this side by side, so you sort of have this crucifix hammock arrangement inside the cabin. There's not really enough room for both of you to put your spacesuits on, because once you've done that, you've occupied all the space in the cabin, and you just got to kind of learn to live there and then, you know, go out for a little walk on the moon and drive on the moon and come back. So Apollo 11 really is about getting onto the moon and knowing you can get there, land safely, and staying long enough to pick up a few rocks and get the hell out of there. But the true exploration happens in the missions after that.
It's worth remembering. So while those guys are spending a few days on the moon, that one solo guy is still in the mothership, just orbiting the moon all by themselves.
So that's Michael Collins, and we've got almost an entire program dedicated to him because he's kind of like the third man of Apollo 11. You know, everyone goes, there's Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and who's the other guy? And Michael Collins is, I mean, so underrated in terms of his role and importance in all of this. He is a fantastic pilot. He is by far and away the most emotionally, I guess, in touch and together of all of the people who give accounts of the Apollo period. And we went to interview him, and it was fantastic because we were told, actually, he's notoriously difficult interviewee at times. Well, he doesn't suffer fools lightly, and so you thought, oh, I better have all my ducks in a row when I go and interview him. And it was funny because he was fantastic and he was very, very generous. But it was like, he's a fighter pilot. And it was like being in a dogfight with a fighter pilot, because you'd think, oh, I'll ask him this question. And as soon as you thought you had him where you wanted him, he was behind you and hosing you down with the guns. And you thought, God. But he you know, he talked to us about how his job was to be there preparing for if it didn't work out. He was supposed to be there as the last line of defense if there was an abort during the landing, or if something went wrong as they're flying off the surface and the engines didn't work properly, he would have to swoop down and fly down somehow and pick this vehicle up. You know, and this isn't just like flying a plane. This is flying a spacecraft with completely different handling. And if it went wrong, everything would depend on him. So he was up there and he had a very quiet time up there while they were on the surface. But all the time he had to be prepared to effect that rescue. And that's what he was trained for.
Well, I'm sure he was difficult, but the BBC sent the right guy. No one gets behind Kevin Fong. And so they spend a couple of hours on the surface. Then how do you... You said they hadn't got any fuel left, so how do they take off and get back to the ship in lunar orbit?
So really, the lunar module is kind of almost like two spacecraft in one. There's an upper stage and a lower stage. The lower stage is the descent stage, and it's got this very sophisticated engine on it that you can throttle. So up until this point, rocket engines were either on or they were off. But the descent stage has this engine on it that you can throttle. So you can control it. You control the engine of your car with an accelerator pedal. And the upper stage has this boost back to orbit engine on it. And the two are on top of each other. So, yes, they've used up almost all of the fuel in the descent engine. But the ascent engine, the second engine, is in the top half of this vehicle. And that's what lifts them off the moon. So, yeah, so that's how they get back to orbit.
So they get back. So there's three. There's so many different spacecraft all in one here. So they get back on this tiny little spacecraft. The docking goes. So the rest of the mission goes okay.
Well, you see, this thing, this lunar orbit rendezvous, which means that you first take two spacecraft together to the moon, then you split off, you land one, and then you come off, join up with your buddy Michael Collins in orbit, and you fly back to the moon in the command module. That rendezvous is non-trivial. It requires you to fly in formation, but fly in formation around the moon, 250,000 miles from Earth. And if anything goes wrong with that rendezvous, if you prang the other vehicle and spring a leak in it, no one's coming to help you. You're done up there. And so all of that flying was extraordinarily precise and important. But despite the ludicrous description of those maneuvers, it is the best and only way to do that mission. So they get together and then they come home. But coming home again is non-trivial because you're flying home as fast as anyone's ever traveled at 25,000 odd miles an hour. And then you have to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere at exactly the right angle. You know, too shallow and you skip off and you disappear forever. Too steep and you stoof into the atmosphere and you burn up in a ball of flame. So exactly the right angle and then splash down in the ocean and then you get picked up by your Navy.
When we next send people to the moon, will the human factor be taken out of it? Will computers do all the flying? And I guess I'm asking, therefore, will they have to send pilots? Just asking for a friend.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, in fact, the narrative we have of the Apollo lunar landing is, the popular narrative is slightly wrong. You know, we say it was this computer that was sort of about as sophisticated as a digital watch, and it was up to nothing. And in the end, it falls over, and Armstrong takes manual control, flies the vehicle to the surface like a space-age tiger moth. And that's only partly true. Yes, Armstrong was a superlative pilot and super cool under pressure. But he is the all-important interface between this very sophisticated computer. And actually, the computer does a lot of heavy lifting for them. The computer smooths out the difference between the pilot's intent and the actual action. You know, no pilot could have controlled all of the valves and all of the mechanisms that were required to fire the rockets and the thrusters to get the vehicle in exactly the right place. It's just too complicated. So yes, you needed an Armstrong there in the final moments to manage some of the decisions. Now, if history has taught us anything, the way to make these complicated systems safe is to paint the human out of the loop wherever you can. That's why you and I are 10 times more likely to survive in our cars today than we were when we were growing up. And it's why road safety and aviation safety has improved over the, you know, since the middle of the 20th century. That said, I don't think you will ever get to the point where you can fully paint the human out of the loop of any of these systems, because at some point, the last line of mitigation has to be a human being able to play some part in that system and try and prevent what is about to be an awful failure. So when we next go to the moon, will there be a largely automated landing? Yes, the computers will assist you all the way down, and you may be able to do a hands-free landing. You may be able to let the computer do it, but there will always be human pilots in the loop of that just in case something goes wrong. It's hard to engineer systems otherwise.
Looks like the kids are going back to flight school. I got big plans for them. Living out my fantasies through my children. My daughter's going to do it. Okay, so Kevin, how can everyone listen to this podcast?
So this is 13 Minutes to the Moon. It's a podcast for the BBC World Service. So you can get it through BBC Sounds or wherever you're listening to this, however you get your podcast, you can get it on that.
Great. Thank you very much, Kevin Fong. That was brilliant, dude.
I feel we have the history on our shoulders.
One child, one teacher, one book.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favour to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favor, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there, law of the jungle out there, and I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.